Was University Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Israel has removed metal detectors from entrances to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, but thousands of Muslim worshippers continued offering prayers outside the mosque in protest. The metal detectors were installed following the July 14th killings of two Israeli police at the site known to Muslims as the Noble Sanctuary and to Jews as the Temple Mount. The decision by the Israeli government was welcomed by the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Nikolai Mladenov.
I welcome last night's decision by the Israeli Security Cabinet to remove the metal detectors while ensuring the security of visitors and worshippers to the holy sites. I hope that the cabinet decision will lead to calming of the current tension and will enable a return of worshippers to the Holy Esplanade.
American University Professor Emeritus Russell Stone said Israel's decision was clearly a concession.
Many Israeli journalists were saying that, in fact, Israel's position is weakened by having taken a stand which was initially unreasonable and then being basically forced to back down.
Israel has introduced other non-intrusive security measures at the site that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and the Waqf, the religious body that oversees Islamic sites in the city, insist are still unacceptable. Meanwhile, Jordan's foreign minister said justice will be sought in the killing of two Jordanians at the Israeli embassy in Amman. A Spanish rescue group Tuesday said it found nearly 170 migrants still alive, but 13 others dead in a rubber boat drifting the Mediterranean. The Proactiva Open Arms NGO said the rescue effort occurred about 24 kilometers north of the Libyan coastal town of Sabratha. This is VOA News. Following French-mediated talks, the prime minister of the UN-backed Government of National Accord in Libya, Fayez al-Sarraj, and the leader of the Libyan National Army, Khalifa Haftar, agreed Tuesday to a conditional ceasefire and pledged to hold elections next year.
Le courage qui est le vôtre aujourd'hui, en étant présent ici,
French President Emmanuel Macron said the decision was courageous and represents an effort at national reconciliation and peace. Libya has been racked by chaos since the ouster of dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, but Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal remains dubious.
Mr. Sarraj doesn't have any military force to enforce the agreement or the contract. The allied forces, particularly the French, may have moral support behind them, but they do not have material support to be able to enforce it.
Haftar, who has pledged loyalty to Libya's eastern administration, has refused to recognize the Tripoli government and boosted his standing after his forces defeated Islamist militia for control of Libya's second-largest city, Benghazi. A U.S. Navy patrol boat fired warning shots at an Iranian vessel in the Persian Gulf that came dangerously close to the ship Tuesday at a high rate of speed. It is the first such incident of its kind during the Trump administration. Regional analyst James Jeffrey of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy said it comes after a series of setbacks by Iran and Syria.
The Iranians hadn't done this for some time. They, through their militias and through the Syrian government, challenged the Trump administration in Syria, and in a series of five different confrontations, they had to back out.
Among those confrontations, he cited the U.S. cruise missile strike targeting a Syrian air base and the downing of an Iranian drone over Syria. Ailing Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's office announced Tuesday the 74-year-old leader will return to his official duties as soon as he gets the all clear from doctors in London. He's been absent from the West African country since May 7 for treatment of an undisclosed illness. A photo of Mr. Buhari smiling while sitting at a table was released Sunday. He also took medical leave back in January. Venezuela's opposition preparing for a two-day general strike Wednesday. Two more people that it named to an alternate Supreme Court in defiance of President Nicolas Maduro's government have been arrested. The opposition is demanding Mr. Maduro abandon plans for an election Sunday to elect a new assembly to rewrite the country's constitution. U.S. markets reached new highs Tuesday trading following strong corporate earnings reports from fast food giant McDonald's and agriculture equipment maker Caterpillar. The broader market S&P 500 index closing at a record 2,477 points. Meanwhile, U.S. consumer confidence jumped to a 16-year high in July with an improving labor market. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 26, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe's parliament amends the constitution to let the president handpick the judges.
It goes against every basic tenet of democracy. You cannot create a situation where you put all the powers in one individual.
Priscilla Missi Hairabwi is an opposition member of parliament. Most Ugandans say their parliament should not change presidential term limit. Campaigning in Angola's August 23rd presidential election is in full swing. Malawi's information minister says the state broadcaster must cover all political parties. And the expelled member of Zambia's ruling party is going to court to challenge his expulsion.
I am a member of parliament. And when a member of parliament is expelled by the sponsoring political party, the member of parliament has got recourse to go to the courts of law for the courts to determine whether the expulsion is illegal or legal.
Tshishimba Kambwili is the expelled member of Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party. And whatever happened to more than $750 million of mining revenue paid to the DRC Treasury between 2013 and 2015? Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe's parliament has amended the country's constitution to empower the president to handpick top judges. Sebastian Mofu has the story from Harare.
Plans to amend the constitution to allow President Robert Mugabe to pick the country's top judges started early this year when the then Chief Justice left the bench after reaching the age of retirement. Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party immediately petitioned the courts to hold public interviews to appoint the next top judge until the constitution had been changed to allow Mugabe to choose the new jurists. The application failed, but ZANU-PF introduced a bill proposing the amendment to ensure the president chooses a chief justice along with the deputy and the head of the High Court, known in Zimbabwe as the judge president. Priscilla Missa Hairabwi, an opposition member of parliament who had campaigned against the constitutional amendment, says the move reverses what Zimbabweans voted for in 2013.
Why do we take away the will of the people? Something that was voted in by millions and millions of Zimbabweans. The second thing is that it goes against every basic tenet of democracy. You cannot create a situation where you put all the powers in one individual.
ZANU-PF parliament member Ziyambi Ziyambi says he sees nothing wrong with the new law that awaits President Mugabe's signature.
I think it's good for democracy. We discovered a lacuna in our law, something that needed to be rectified, and the bill was tabled in parliament. We did all the due processes. It was realized that there were some impractical things which were within that constitution. For instance, the outgoing chief justice who have to interview his successor is something that is not attainable.
The opposition has criticized the amendment as a direct reversal of the will of the people. The 2013 constitution, passed by a popular referendum, limited presidential powers, including removing Mugabe's ability to handpick judges. Observers say the amendment could have implications for the 2018 elections, as the Supreme Court will decide on who rules on any poll disputes. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Uganda's parliament is considering an amendment to the country's constitution on land issues, but it is another proposed revision, not on the table, that is sparking the fiercest debate. Alima Atumani has a story from Kampala.
Uganda's constitution sets the age range for president at 35 to 75 years of age. Born in 1944, President Yoweri Museveni will be 76 years old at the next elections in 2021. That means after three decades in power, he will not be eligible to stand for re-election. But Deputy Attorney General Mwesigwa Rukutana has discussed amending the constitution. The public reacted quickly, urging legislators not to touch Article 1 or 2, Section B. Ruling Party MP David Abala explains.
The first thing that was done was to make sure all our telephone contacts are thrown to the Facebook. Anybody can say anything. So as members of parliament, we have been described as gluttons. They say members of parliament have been paid $107,000. And some of them are calling me. They hire arresters. They say, we trust you. But please, no, do not tamper that article 102 about age limit.
No amendment to the age limit has been put before parliament. But that has not stopped the opposition. Last week, Democratic Party President Norbert Mao and some members of his party marched to the Constitutional Square to hang a banner. Mao and 14 other people were arrested. They were released later, the same day.
Our slogan, if you dare and touch it, meaning that provision of the Constitution, there will be a reckoning. This is the last barricade against life presidency. It is the last defense against Museveni's family's despotic ambitions. We had the term limits. The term limits were removed. We thought this one now would not be able to be removed. It turns out the age limit is also a false bottom because it will not hold Museveni.
The president's supporters also sprang into action. Presidential advisor on political affairs, Devin Mafabi, held a meeting for ruling party youth leaders, legislators and academics. He told VOA they are launching a countrywide campaign to lift the presidential age limit. President Museveni has defended Mafabi, saying his advisor was provoked.
I hear that there is a debate about age limit and I don't know what. What are you debating? Who has brought a proposal? So those indisciplined people, they should know that there will be counter action, political action, because if you play games, the other side will react. So you shouldn't waste your time with people who have no work to do.
Museveni has not said whether he supports lifting the age limit. Opposition legislator Semuju Nganda of the Forum for Democratic Change says this is characteristic of the president.
He will act through proxies. So therefore, this is a legitimate matter. So even if Museveni wanted or he didn't want, this is the right time for Uganda to begin discussing the transition either from Museveni to Museveni or transition from Museveni to another person.
Only the Attorney General can introduce a constitutional amendment to Parliament. The proposed amendment on land rights is currently before a parliamentary committee. The Attorney General's office has not said whether it will propose any further amendments to Parliament at this time. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Campaigning Angola's August 23rd presidential election, which began this past Sunday, is in full swing. The ruling Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, MPLA, and the main opposition, National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, UNITA, on Tuesday took their campaigns to the provinces. The motto of the MPLA, which has ruled the country since independence in 1974, is improve what is good and correct what is wrong. The party is also promising to redistribute wealth equitably and improve the business climate. But veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai says the opposition UNITA party took its campaign to the Central Highlands province to criticize the government of longtime President Eduardo dos Santos for presiding over corruption while the poor continues to languish in poverty.
This Tuesday, the MPLA presidential candidate, General Juan Lourenco, went to Wambo, province capital in Central Islands, one of the most important electoral provinces. João Lourenço, a center speech at a mass meeting at Wambo, saying that corruption must not be unpunished. According to João Lourenço and the MPLA motto, improve what is good and correct what is wrong, the ruling party promises to distribute national wealth more equally and to improve business climate. We must take note that the opposition parties like UNITA, which also this day went to Central Islands and the South, like Namibo province, has been criticizing the Dos Santos government as corrupt, with the authorities crushing dissidents and Angola citizens suffering that poverty as the presidential family becomes usually wealthy.
You said that the ruling MPLA is promising to distribute wealth equitably. Has this happened before? Because people have complained that the Angolan government has not used the oil wealth properly.
Yes. In fact, this is one of the most important problems and one of, I would say, the main themes of the electoral campaign. if the MPLA are promising to do better, the opposition parties are taking the opportunity to criticize the huge corruptions amongst the presidential family and the MPLA leadership. The opposition parties are calling for not only a changing on the current laws, but also that these peoples, which alleged has been taking some state patrimony, must be go to trial and put all this wealth back on the state.
I was reading about Angola, and then I read that both the ruling party and the opposition challengers have all been given free airtime on the, I think, television or radio. I thought this was kind of strange, because in some African countries where the governments control the radio and television stations, they normally don't give the challenging candidate any free time. Is this the case in Angola?
More or less. According to the law, and this has happened also in the last general elections in 2012, all parties have been giving 10 minutes airtime at the state-run TV to promote these manifestos and the programs. But the matter of the problem is that, according not only opposition parties, but also civil society groups, most of state-run televisions are pro-government propaganda.
Mario Alpaivai is a veteran Angolan journalist. He was speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. Today's Wednesday, July 26th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. Malawi's information minister has urged the Malawi Broadcasting Corporation to give coverage to all political parties in the country. Nicholas Diouzi says the move could end political favoritism at the state broadcaster, which is often accused by the opposition of bias in favor of the ruling party, while at the same time blacklisting all opposition groups. Information Minister Diouzi tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the Malawi Broadcasting Corporation has an obligation to open its doors even to those who do not agree with the policies of the government.
Not necessarily instructing them, but advising them to be objective so that people will be able to hear their views with diversity.
What prompted you to advise them as such?
Because we think that we have to conform by the rules of professional ethics.
Some of your critics are saying that Malawi has about 58 registered political parties. It will be very tough or very challenging for the state broadcast to cover all of them evenly.
That is indeed a challenge. We have 58 political parties. I think we are now having 59 of the new registered political parties by our former vice president. But what we think is that all broadcasting house must conform to the ethics and the professional standards that we aspire and incorporate embedded democratic tenets. That's all we advise them.
Isn't the state broadcaster, particularly the NBC, obligated under the Constitution to open its doors even to those that do not agree with the policies of the government, or in that matter, any ruling government?
I think that, in life there has always been development within the media fraternity. And if you read correctly, even in the established democracies, there has been a process of media metamorphosis when people were able to change from subjective to objective. Well, that's what the world is. And I think it's good constantly to remind each other to conform to ethics and the professionalism so that at the end of the day we achieve what will be common good for all of us.
So, Mr. Diouzi, will there be a policy direction from the government to train or educate some of these government-employed broadcasters in NBC to be fair and exhibit the ethics of fairness in their broadcast as you suggested or advised them to do?
My suggestion did not come because they are unfair. They are fair, but we want to encourage them to improve on the fairness and to make sure that they live to the aspirations of the people.
Well, as the information minister and chief government spokesman, what has been your interaction with them so far?
Not only NBC, but any broadcasting house. As information minister, we have very cordial relation, and we think that as a ministry, we have to facilitate and continue to look after the professional standards, encourage them, and in fact, if the Voice of America can be so kind, they can second some of our staff so that they learn more. You know, education doesn't end. It consists of three C's, and that is continuation, conservation, and concentration. So we really need more training, capacity building, and with the latest innovation of ICT, we think that we can be able to educate our young men.
Nicholas Dawusi is Malawi's information minister. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. The expelled member of Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party says he's going to court to challenge his expulsion. Chishimba Kambwili says only the courts can determine the legality or illegality when a member of parliament is expelled by a sponsoring political party. Kambwili was expelled this week by the party's central committee for being disrespectful to President Edgar Lungu when he walked out of the committee's gathering, which was being chaired by the president. Party deputy spokesman Father Frank Bualia referred to Kambwili as a cancer that needed to be cut out. But Kambwili says he was expelled because he plans to challenge President Lungu for the party's leadership in the 2021 presidential election.
This thing is not about being in discipline or anything else. It's just about the 2021 presidential and general elections. The current sitting president does not want to be challenged at the convention according to the party constitution. Our party constitution states, and I quote, "The president of the party shall be elected at the general conference every after 5 years." But these people have started manipulating the system to say that is going to be the sole candidate in 2020 at the General Conference. Now, some of us who believe in democratic tenancy have said that, no, we have to go by the Constitution. And because of that, they've decided to come up with frenzy charges, disciplinary charges, just for the purpose of kicking me out of the party. And what transpired on Saturday was a kangaroo court. And because of that, I have decided to challenge the expulsion in the courts of law. Typical of African politics, people want to intimidate others. In Africa, when you show interest to challenge the sitting president, they want to criminalize, you know, ambition. And that should come to an end.
You said you have decided to challenge the expulsion in a court of law. What legal remedy do you have? It's a political party. Don't they have the right to expel you if they feel that you can no longer be a member?
I am a member of parliament. And when a member of parliament is expelled by the sponsoring political party, the member of parliament has got recourse to go to the courts of law for the courts to determine whether the expulsion is illegal or legal. If the court finds that the expulsion is illegal, they would allow the member of parliament to continue as member of parliament as an independent or to continue the membership of the sponsoring political party.
I want you to answer the critics. As I said, we spoke with Mr. Bualia. Does he describe you as a cancer within the ruling PF that had to be gotten rid of? Other people say that what happened to you is symptomatic of your own doing. Some people describe you as arrogant.
First and foremost, let me say that Father Frank Bualia is one who can be described by many people as a very inconsistent person. The man does not work. He has no business. He is looked after by the head of state. The head of state pays his rent, gives him money to buy food, and has bought him a car. So you'd understand that such a person would not have an independent mind. So if the head of state tells him to turn to the left, you turn to the left. He's not the right person to speak on such matters, because I can describe him as a bootlicker.
Have you already taken your case to court?
We've already taken a notice to go to court, and we've served the National Assembly a copy of the letter. And my lawyers are busy working on the papers, and we should be filing our papers in court latest by Thursday morning.
Chishimba Kambwili is a former member of Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. More than $750 million of mining revenues paid by companies to state bodies in the Democratic Republic of Congo was lost to the Treasury between 2013 and 2015, according to a report released last Friday by Global Witness. The money disappeared into a dysfunctional state-owned mining company called Geke Mines. Global Witness senior campaigner Peter Jones says the revenues once contributed more than 40% of Congo's budget and benefited the Congolese people. But he tells viewers Ricky Schreier that all that has changed.
The problem is that Geke Mines has now collapsed, as we say. Essentially, it's hugely in debt. It doesn't mine any minerals itself anymore, and all it does is sign contracts with major mining companies so they can develop the land. And so now the onus is on Geke Mines to kind of monetize the mining permits. It's kind of a caretaker, we say, of the natural resource wealth within Congo. The problem is that if it strikes bad deals and isn't able to monetize these permits, then the contribution that it's making to the government treasury and to the budget is much, much smaller. So that means that the amount of money available for the government to spend on things like hospitals and schools is going down. And obviously that has terrible consequences for the people in Congo.
Is there a way to put an annual dollar figure on this, like how much on an annual basis does the Congolese public lose out on due to the dysfunction of the mining section?
Yeah, it's a bit difficult to talk annually. But generally, so what we've done is look at a three-year period where we were able to get some relatively comprehensive statistics and data. And over that three-year period, we found that about $750 million of payments that were made by private mining companies working in Congo. So these are payments in terms of taxes that they pay. They pay fees called royalties. They pay those to Geke Mines, state mining company, but also to the government. Of all of that money, $750 million went into the state mining company or went into the national tax agencies and didn't come out the other side.
That's just simply the Geke Mines missing portion. Your report also talks about where other money goes missing in contract signings, in lost taxes not being collected. Am I correct in saying that?
So we've broken it down into various different levels. So essentially what we think is the most suspicious and the most opaque and the most problematic is with Geke Mines, the state mining company, and with the three national tax agencies. The figure that goes into those four agencies combined is $750 million. But this is what we've done for years, and other researchers and other journalists have also covered this, is look at the contracts that are being signed in the mining sector. Often suspicious deals are signed with offshore companies, which means that Congo isn't getting the full value of its mining assets. So that's what we kind of think of as the offshore story. This is money that's flowing, the value of the mining sector flowing into offshore companies. With this report, what we try to do is look at, okay, so that value's gone offshore. What happens to the onshore payments? What happens to the payments that go into the tax agencies? What happens to the payments that go into the state mining company? And what we found is that even with these as well, on top of all that loss to offshore companies, even these payments that are onshore don't actually reach the treasury necessarily.
Peter Jones is Global Witness senior campaigner. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. And that's it for this Wednesday, July 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a very nice day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss Rwanda's August 4th presidential election. Incumbent Paul Kagame is widely expected to win another term. The amended constitution allows him to remain in power until 2034 if he pursues it. A preview of Rwanda's presidential election.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.